the moment, society is going through a crisis of a kind which we've never quite experienced before. The main symptom of this crisis is that people are not getting what they want. Just to take a couple of examples, people across the world will want peace and they get war. Or you may want jobs and get unemployment. People want comfort and security, but you can forget that unless you happen to have inherited it. And even capitalists who invest to make a profit complain that they want even more profit, and they're at each other's throats, competing to see who can exploit the workforce most efficiently and squeeze most profit out of their employees. I'd like to try to show two things tonight about this crisis. Firstly, that none of the major social problems that we're facing can be solved on its own, in isolation from other problems. And secondly, that that joint solution, which will solve all of the major social problems together, is to have conscious control over society, which will mean abolishing the system of the market. Now, there are many aspects of the kind of crisis I'm talking about, many contradictions. Firstly, you have mountains of food abundance, such as this one, which was shown in the newspaper a while ago. It says, multiply this picture 600 times. That's what the common market cereal mountain really looks like. And at the same time, last year, 15 million people in the world died of starvation. And since 120,000 died at Hiroshima, you can work it out that that's one Hiroshima every 3 days, simply from starvation. There's an increasingly obvious class division. You have the pageant of the royal wedding and events like Ascot, and at the same time nearly 3 million on the dole, with unemployment benefits being cut by 5% every year in real terms. There's an increasing wish to redirect resources, to have public spending of resources, to take it away from the destructive weapons and to have creative jobs. And then there's an increasing despair and frustration when people realise that that is not what is happening. Even across the so-called Iron Curtain, in the countries where capital is in the hands of the state and profit is made by the state on behalf of a few privileged Communist Party chiefs, they are suffering from the crisis as well. As you can see in Poland, where austerity is having to be imposed, the same as in the West. And in Hungary, where Janos Kadar, the Communist Party leader, recently said that after a quarter of a century of relative liberalism since 1956, must now come to an end, and a tougher line is needed with more censorship and political control. We know much more close to home that there are increasing racist attacks where people look for a scapegoat for the kind of austerity which is being imposed. And in the background all the time there's an increasing militarism at the same time. So the aid from the main industrial countries to the less developed nations in comparison with the military donations to those countries is in the ratio of 1 to 22. Sigvard Eklund, the International Atomic Energy Agency head, has recently estimated that there are now 50,000 nuclear warheads in the world, with a total force of 1 million Hiroshimas. And in fact, world spending on weapons is now running at £1 million a minute, every minute of the day and night. That's the kind of militarism which exists. And in this crisis, there is an increasing polarisation. People are being forced into one camp or the other, either of conservatism or of revolution. People are looking for a way out of the crisis, and some people are turning to increasing law and order to stamp out any kind of disagreement, to increase repression and set up army camps, whilst other people are realising that there are barriers which will have to be totally broken down to make way for a new form of society. Well, unfortunately, a lot of people are reacting to all this with despair and bewilderment. In particular, groups such as the Green Parties, the Ecology Parties, who say that we must escape back to nature, who are a modern form of the Luddites, who respond to increasing machinery and technology by trying to destroy it, instead of trying to take it into our control and making something of it. And that kind of fear and insecurity is the dangerous fear and insecurity which has led in the past to fascism. In the Daily Mail recently, there was a letter which said, the police should be backed up by troops with rubber bullets and tear gas. Unless this government takes positive steps to stamp out this type of behaviour, I, and possibly thousands like me, will vote for any party which would try and deter this mob violence. Any party. Well, this crisis is not a crisis of conscience. It's not a moral or religious dilemma. It's plainly rooted in the economic system that exists. It's a political crisis. It's not even a crisis of what people refer to as human nature. It's not the question of increasing evil, which many people are trying to use to explain things. For example, in a recent television series, Richard Leakey, the famous anthropologist, demonstrated over several hours of programmes that there is no evidence to show that humans are naturally aggressive or uncooperative. And in his final programme, he showed the Kung Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert who live a peaceful life, and he showed how some of them are being enlisted into the South African army to fight against Namibia. And one of the oldest people of the Kung hunting and gathering people said, "We were a peaceful group of people until the modern people from South Africa came along and taught us to fight and taught us aggression." Well, to move on to the subject of war itself, there is obviously an increasing drive towards militarism, not just with conventional weapons of the old-fashioned kind, but also with nuclear weapons, biological and chemical weapons. Even in space, the race carries on, so that out of 89 Russian space launches last year, 81 of them were for military purposes. And the American MX missile system, if it goes ahead, will take up 20,000 square miles of the Nevada desert and will be the biggest construction project in human history, all in the cause of killing human beings. Obviously, there are many wars going on right now. Chemical weapons have been used in Afghanistan and in Southeast Asia. And there are wars been going on effectively in El Salvador, Northern Ireland, Iraq, Iran, Israel, Syria. And in fact, every day since the so-called declaration of peace after the Second World War, there has been a war somewhere, whether it's in Vietnam or Algeria or Ethiopia. And each of these wars has its own separate history of human misery. Any of the flashpoints, such as Afghanistan or Poland or in the Middle East, could potentially lead to a conflict between these superpowers. And with the American official policy moving from the mutual assured destruction policy last year to the new policy, which is called Presidential Directive 59, that change in policy means that instead of relying on the idea of two opposing superpowers which won't attack each other, because if they do, they will destroy each other, the new policy is to move towards the idea of trying to have conventional conflicts, to play out the economic struggles in supposedly limited wars. And the government booklet, Protect and Survive, puts a very chilling note on this whole question of the increasing drive towards war, when it advises people to form makeshift nuclear shelters under the stairs. And it advises us that if a death occurs while you are confined in the fallout room, place the body in another room and confine it as securely as possible. Attach an identification. That's the kind of bureaucratic priorities to keep up the present law and order, even in the case of a terrible nuclear attack. Now, moving away from all of the details of war and the terrible weapons, because I'm sure we all know all about that, let's move on to actually look at what war is. War is not natural. It's obviously caused by some artificial human agency. War is caused by the world market system in the modern world of today. Let me just draw to your attention some aspects of that market system. Firstly, all of the resources which we all need to live and to work on cooperatively are the private or state property of a small band of people. For example, the Royal Commission on the Distribution of Wealth in Britain last year said that the richest 1% in this country own more wealth than the poorer 80%, which must include practically everyone. And in fact, 1/1000th of the population have more than 4/5 of all the shares, all the stocks and shares, in other words, the ownership of industry. And the second principle of this market system is that the rest of us, who own practically nothing apart from our own work, ability to work, are forced to sell that ability to work in order to survive. We look for people to employ us, to exploit our labour. And we sell that labour power to them as a commodity like any other. And the money which we receive in return for it is only roughly enough to live, whether you're receiving a wage which runs out in the middle of the week or a salary which runs out in the middle of the month. It's still a price on your head, a price tag for your mental and physical services. Now, obviously, people who employ us in that way are not doing it out of benevolence or for fun. You only have to look at some of the millionaires, which you can read about in the paper any day without a socialist telling you about it, to understand that their life is based upon the work of others, not upon the work of themselves. Their vast fortunes represent the work of thousands of people, not just of one person. So the basic principle of this system is for us to produce goods and services for that minority and for them to then sell them back to us, making a profit. And the profit comes from the fact that the wages they're paying us are so small, just enough to live on, that they're less than the massive wealth that we have created. Having established those basic principles, I must add that the main point of capitalism, the market system, is competition, and it works in the East and the West. Competition between nations, competition between the two classes, obviously, one of whom are being forced to sell themselves in this way, to prostitute their own abilities for the sake of profit, and the other, who is actually benefiting from accumulating the product of that labour. But the main competition is carried out between companies who fight to see who can exploit us most, who fight to see who can make most profit. And in this struggle, they have many tactics at their disposal. The main tactic used by companies in the world today, and used by institutions like the Russian Empire, which claims to be socialist but isn't, the main tactic is to lower labour costs, to push down and to pressurise all the time what we are able to take back in our wage packets, and to introduce machinery to displace human beings, anything to cut costs, to introduce mass production, to expand and to grow and to accumulate, all in the name of profit and in the name of capital. And that is how wars are caused, by companies trying to expand across the world, trying to take over one another's markets, trying to persuade us to buy back their products and not the next company's products. That's what led to the last two world wars, when Germany and Japan, as nations, tried to expand on behalf of the companies in that area, and threatened the old colonial empires of countries like Britain. Just to put a fine point on this, let me quote some of the experts themselves, such as John Knott, the Minister of Defence, who recently said on television, defending the rapid deployment force, we have crucial minerals, and in fact our ore supplies to defend. Of course, he didn't explain who he meant by us and our ore supplies, because I certainly don't possess any. If I did, I wouldn't have to work for a living. And another example, Caspar Weinberger, the American equivalent, he said, the United States is making enormous increases in its efforts to safeguard the oil fields of Southwest Asia and the Arabian Gulf, areas that are of vital concern to Japan. The United States helps to protect the vital sea lanes upon which Japan depends for its global trade. And in fact, he was trying to persuade Japan to contribute a few more murderous bombs to the joint effort of America and Japan to protect this trade, this financial profit which is being extracted on behalf of a minority. And there are many examples of wars fought in this way, such as the war between Iran and Iraq over the Hormuz Straits, a trade route for taking the profit, transporting the profit in the end to the capitalist who possesses the companies. This present increase in militarism of recent times results directly from a depression, from a crisis that I referred to at the beginning. The markets, the areas where the goods are sold to realise this profit, are effectively contracting, because we, who produce all the wealth, can't afford to buy it all back. We can't even afford to have and to use the wealth that we have created. And so in the natural process of capitalism, there is a cycle where market demand goes up, people can afford things in the time of a boom, and then production is increased so much that there is overproduction for the market. And then we produce so much that we can't afford to buy it back, and so the circle returns full circle. Now, at the moment, the depression results from the fact that there has been overproduction. It doesn't mean that there aren't starving millions, it doesn't mean that we, sitting in this room, don't have what we want, but there's overproduction for the market. And in the 1890s, and again in the 1920s, both previous times that there was this kind of level of unemployment, there has been a world war to end that depression, to have the final arbiter over who controls the markets, which capitalist will sell his goods to the workers who can barely afford them. So not a single war has actually been won by the working class, that's to say all of us here, people who have to work for a living, regardless of what job you do. We haven't won a single war, because there is a class war in every single nation, and those wars are only fought on behalf of a small minority who profit from the wars that they win, and who lose profits in the wars that they lose. Now, I did say that my main object was to explain how the market system doesn't only cause war, with all of its horrors, but it's also responsible for unemployment, for poverty, for pollution, and every other major problem. And I think the reason is fairly simple. The market system means production for profit. It means you have to sell goods for prices, for money. It means there has to be a gap between wages on the one hand and between the profits, the value of the goods we've produced, on the other, so that the middleman, the capitalist, can take his cut without lifting a finger. That's the market system, and it depends upon having markets where you can take those goods and say to people, now buy them, otherwise they'll go to rot and the capitalist won't receive his profit. Now at the moment we produce so many goods that there is a glut, and that is how the market causes unemployment, because the capitalist turns around with his stocks and shares, with his factory, with his cars, with his houses, and says, you've produced enough, we can't sell it, that's it. How can you expect me to employ you, to pay you a wage, to ask you to create wealth, when there's nobody to buy it anymore? You're all too poor to buy it. And so the blame, in fact, is put on us. We're too poor to buy back the wealth, so we get booted out. So you see how the market system of profit causes wars and it causes unemployment. Now this system of capitalism is kept in being by misguided allegiances. People feel themselves allied to their nation. They stick up for their nation. They go and celebrate the royal wedding. They wave their flags. They defend their companies. And it's that that maintains capitalism in being, because what you're doing indirectly is supporting the people who own that country, the people who control the stock exchange, the government who operates on behalf of that parasitical minority. Let me just give you an example of where people's true interests lie. I won't tell you who this is speaking for the moment, see if you can guess. A lot of people would agree with it. And the person said, I think that people realise that their future depends on loyalty to and cooperation with their own company. That's something quite fundamental. And this, of course, was my aim. There aren't any prizes for guessing that was, in fact, Margaret Thatcher. And it makes the point very clearly. Are you going to follow Margaret Thatcher and have loyalty to your company, to the very people who are exploiting you, who are, in fact, ultimately sucking us dry of a life which is incomparable to what we could have and what we've got now, if we were able to enjoy the full fruits of our labour, to control them democratically, without that excess, that surplus, having to be sucked off by the parasites who actually own the company? Are you going to follow Mrs. Thatcher and support that company, or are you going to go to work for that company in the knowledge that you can organise with your fellow workers to actually end that system of exploitation? Now, the first stage in coping with war is to get rid of nationalism supporting the nation. This is obviously inculcated through very early conditioning. But that is important, because I think that the title of tonight's meeting did include a reference to CND. And I do want to come and make some brief comments about CND now. CND, on the whole, may not agree with what I've just said about the need to get rid of nationalism. They would agree about the horrors of war, and many of them may even agree about the horrors of unemployment, and even some of them may even agree about the horrors of employment, when you have to work for somebody and be exploited by them. But on the whole, CND is a nationalist body. And I think I've got a quote here which will show you what I mean. They had an advert in The Guardian recently. And they said, we are the first to admit that there are risks in disarmament, nor do we propose total disarmament for Britain. Without nuclear weapons, Britain would still be mightily armed. We are now spending more on conventional weapons than ever before in peacetime. And incidentally, that advert was paid for by an anonymous Sheffield manufacturer, an owner of a company. Now, you see how CND is not with us on this principle of class division, of class struggle as the only way forward to deal with war and all of its horrors. Ban the bomb campaigners, well-meaning as they are, cannot wish to live. They cannot say, we demand the right to live. In the abstract, you must first say how you're going to live. You must define it. How do we want to live? You can't succeed in a negative act of getting rid of bombs and war unless you have a positive idea of what to replace it with. How do you want to live? So many CNDers, some of the leading CNDers, speak of the need to save civilization from destruction. But what do they mean? Is it the civilization of Dokyu, or of pollution and struggle and unnecessary austerity? Is it the civilization of state violence, political torturing across the world? Is it the civilization of legalized plunder? So first we've got to question the nature of the civilization we want. But this civilization we've got at the moment is what is actually the culprit for producing wars in all their forms and for producing bombs. From an early age, young children are given Action Man toys to play with. And then they're given the Bible, which teaches them that wars can be just and holy. And then they're given flags to wave and nations to talk about and to associate with and to ask each other at school, what are you? Are you English or French? Or are you black or white? Now, I've got a quote here from a government booklet for children trying to recruit them in the army. It does start by saying this is not a recruiting booklet, but I think you'll agree with me that it certainly is. Let me just read you something from it. I think it might interest you. It starts off, some believe that there is no need for war, and few of us would disagree with that. But although it seems unlikely that any country would risk starting a nuclear war, there are still a few who are willing to start a little war, rather than settle their differences around the conference table. You notice how there's willfully tricking young children who may not understand what they're implying. This means that even in peacetime, the services are constantly preparing and training and practicing for war. When you first join, notice they said it wasn't a recruiting booklet, you will spend several hours each week drilling on the parade ground, being shouted at by instructors, and marching about in all sorts of ways that won't make much sense to you at first. This is because there is no better way of teaching men to act together and obey orders quickly. Anyone who is lazy and disobedient and whose behaviour is just not good enough can expect to be dealt with. The forces don't want men who won't fit in. Am I willing to run the risk of being killed or wounded myself? And am I willing to kill or injure people of another country in defence of my own? This is a moral decision, and only you can make it. Well, it's not a moral decision, it's a class decision. Because if you are in that class of people which possesses millions of stocks and shares and land and factories, then yes, it is your own country. You can fight for it and die for it, for all I care. But if you are in the class of people who doesn't, if you have to work for a living, if you don't receive dividends on the doormat without having to work for them, then it's not your own, it's not your country, and you'd be stupid to die fighting for it. In fact, the army, there was an advert in the newspaper recently for 900 army officers which they wanted to boss around other mugs who have joined up. And they say there, your part will be to prepare for a war everyone prays will never happen. I see they teach them religion in the forces as well. It will be difficult to remember that you are still protecting your country and all you love most. Well, I only ask you to look around the country today and tell me what it is you love about it. We might have a discussion in a moment. My contention is there is nothing to love about it and there is nothing to fight for, neither for us nor for the Russian workers or the French workers or any other workers who in fact are exploited by having to work for wages and salaries which are worth much less than what we are actually creating. In fact, there was a man called Kim Il-sung, the premier of North Korea, who has the cheek to call himself a communist, I think I've got that right. But he says, the most important thing in war preparation, in my opinion, is that we educate our people in the spirit of hating the enemy. Well, that makes it pretty clear. That's war for you, hating the enemy. And notice you have to educate the people. It's not natural aggression. It has to be inculcated for the sake of the nation, for the sake of profit. So let's just get to grips with this question of the nation. A few weeks ago, they announced on the radio that ambulance men were having to work an 80-hour week for £132. And that they were dissatisfied with having to work 80 hours a week for £132 and were therefore going to go on strike. Now, before they went on strike, the ambulance men were part of the nation. Every politician would stand up and pat them on the back and say, the heroic ambulance men, and so they are, looking after people, saving lives, working extremely hard. As soon as they say they're going on strike, they're excluded. They're no longer part of the nation. They suddenly become workers, trade unionists, militants. They're putting a spanner in the works. So they're not quite sure that they're part of the nation anymore. You often hear talk about the trade unionists ruining the country. Do you ever hear the radio announce that there are over 10 million trade unionists in this country, plus their dependents, plus their families, which must come to at least half the population? But it's treated as a minority, which doesn't matter. And above all, you hear talk about the workers. But But do you ever hear it mentioned that the workers are over 90% of the population? If it means anything at all, it must mean people who are forced to work. When you know they're all forced to work, it's only a very small minority who possess so much property to make up for the rest of us possessing none, that they don't have to work. So this idea of the nation is a contrig. And the idea of the national interest is a contrig. And our objection to CND is simply that most of them have fallen for it. The national interest. What is in the national interest? Ask any politician, practically any party, apart from this one. And the answers will probably be that you should take lower wages. You should have a cut in wages, in fact. You should work longer hours. It's in the national interest, don't you know? And you should work harder. And what does all that mean? Lower wages, higher profits. But you'd think it'd be the other way around. Most of us form the nation. Most of us have to work for wages, not profits. So in that case, it's in the national interest to have higher wages, not lower wages. But the reason for this confusion is that the politicians who come on the radio and speak about the need for lower wages and higher profits are speaking on behalf of the profit mongers, the people who possess capital, companies who receive profits. So the ultimate mistake is to die in defence of your master's property. You must choose whether you're going to do that or whether you're going to take the other extreme and actually the other sensible alternative and actually fight in the interests of your own class by campaigning for the victory of that class in the struggle which is going on all the time between them. That is a choice. Do you have production for profit of the minority or production for the use of the community? Do you have a system of blind destruction of human lives, or do you have a system of conscious, careful creation? Now, one other point about CND and very many other bodies like it is that they are a reformist organisation. They're not socialist. They think that you can modify the present state of affairs gradually and gradually improve it. Well, that's a fair contention. Let's look at it. What it means is that they have to support one of the major governments to engineer their reforms through Parliament. And I think CND have recently said that they are in fact prepared to do that, to support any government which would say they not support nuclear bombs. But there's a problem. If that government has been elected on the old conservative basis of running capitalism, there's going to be a dilemma. It's going to be a problem. Because as soon as the government gets in, and CND say to the government, come on, you're a good Labour government, Michael Foot, or even Tony Benn, whoever they persuaded to support the idea, abolish nuclear weapons, they're not going to be able to, because they're there to run capitalism, which means nuclear weapons. It means whatever weapons are cheapest and most destructive. Now, to make this clear, about in 1966, I'm afraid it's going back a bit, but it still makes the point. Dennis Healey, Labour politician in the Commons, he was then the defence spokesman. He says, while the government attaches the highest importance to making progress in the field of arms control and disarmament, we must also take what practical steps we can to ensure that this country does not fail to secure its rightful share of the valuable commercial markets. Back to what I was talking about. As long as you've got a Labour government or a Tory government or whatever stuck in this market system of profit and property, you're stuck with weapons of a very destructive kind, whatever form they may happen to take. Then you have some religious people supporting CND, whilst other religious people have been kissing cannons and blessing holy wars. Now that seems odd, but it's because it's a vague moral conviction. It's one moral view against another. There's no way of checking which is right. So the answer is, to reject religious faith, obviously, is to take our own lives into our own hands if we're going to avoid the kind of calamities which strike people when they are living in blindness. After the First World War, the League of Nations was set up as a reformist body to try to placate nations and avoid war, but it failed. After the Second World War, same thing. The United Nations was set up, and in its charter, it says, we will cut the causes of war at their roots. Did they abolish capitalism? Did they have a society of communism, of common ownership, socialism? They didn't. And therefore, we've had hundreds of wars since then. The Peace Society, not to labour the point, was formed after the Napoleonic Wars over 100 years ago. And it still exists. Hundreds of wars, millions of deaths later, because it refuses to accept that capitalism causes war. So war results from how society is organised, just like unemployment, just like the basic poverty we all suffer. And that's what's got to be changed. Moral and emotional appeals for an abstract ideal of peace will continue to fail. We've got to be clear about what causes war and what to do about it. And I noticed in a recent CND leaflet, They say, remember, most alliances and arms races of the past have led to wars. Be warned. But that's totally confused. They haven't actually caused the wars. They've just been part of it. That's just one of the minor symptoms that you get alliances and you have an arms race. The actual cause of war goes deeper. Why do nations have an arms race? Because they want to defend their markets, the profits of the companies that they represent. Finally, on this subject of trying to reform the system in this liberal manner, which comes unstuck, if any of you read The Guardian, you'll see that it's given a lot of support to CND recently. But when it comes to the crunch, when there is an economic conflict, The Guardian wholeheartedly supports British capitalism. It supports British industrialists. It supports people of the kind of Tiny Rowland, or the Duke of Westminster, or the royal family, or whoever it may be who possesses the capital in the country. The Guardian will defend them. And on the 4th of September 1939, when the last war broke out, despite all of the campaigns of the pacifists in the 30s, this is what The Guardian said. We are now at war, and there is no further room for argument. Quiet living has ended. We are plunged into a new world of desperate hopes and fears. Nothing can give us more confidence than the manner in which these last days Parliament has represented the spirit of the people. It has been the great justification of the democratic principle and of the liberty and freedom for which we have taken up arms. Now that is a contrick, again, on behalf of The Guardian and all of the other liberal supporters of that system. If they took up arms for freedom and democracy in 1939, why didn't they do it in 1933 or 1934, when Jews or trade unionists and many others in Germany were being locked away and maltreated in all sorts of ways, if they were so concerned about democracy? If they're so concerned about democracy, why do they have an alliance with Stalin in 1941, an even more notorious dictator than Hitler? And why was it that soon after the outbreak of war, the Defence of the Realm Act was passed to muzzle any political opposition whatsoever in Britain, to the extent that the Socialist Party of Great Britain, which was the only party in Britain to oppose utterly every single war, including both world wars, was muzzled, were told that you can't produce your paper. That kind of attitude shows that it wasn't so much democracy they were terribly worried about on the part of somebody like Churchill. They were worried about defending British markets, as they've said many times, from German economic capitalist expansion. So if we've ended nationalism, if you've got rid of those prejudices about supporting your country, your queen, your government, your politicians and your bosses, where does it leave us? It leaves us with each other, the people who have share common problems. For the same reason, we all have to go out to work or sign on at the dole and make the best of that. Having got rid of nationalism, the path is clear for socialism, which spells the international unity of one class, the working class, including the people at the moment who are being possibly even more terribly oppressed than we are in countries which have the audacity to call themselves socialist. So what is socialism? Let me just end now by trying to give a brief definition of what we mean by socialism. Socialism is a society in which all of the resources will be commonly owned. The factories will not have any name written on them or under them on the title deeds. Everything will belong to everybody. There will be no state controlling it, locking the gates at 5 o'clock. It will be commonly owned by all. And there will be no frontiers, no national boundaries, or property, or state forces. It will be one common world, one human family operating their affairs together. And as I said earlier, it means conscious control. You control your own affairs, how we want to control them, to produce for direct use of ourselves, free of any money or financial restraints, according to a clear plan. You plan your needs ahead. Instead of having the anarchic market forces, which work at the moment, whereby prices rule our lives and create untold misery, instead you plan democratically. What do we want? What do we need? We'll make it. We'll consume it. And as for pound notes, they can be burnt, every last one of them. Because they're totally meaningless once you've got rid of the whole system of profit by which a small minority benefit from the labours of the rest of society. That's a democratic society, and it has to be achieved by democratic political means, which is why this party holds meetings to try democratically to persuade other people of the validity of our case so that you can join us to help campaign to spread these ideas. And there are many forces at work in society which make it hardly necessary for us to tell people what the problems they're facing are. There'll be no war in socialism because it's a worldwide society without any profits or markets to fight over. It's a society without unemployment where people are forced not to work. Everybody is free to work. It's a society without employment. You're not employed by somebody or something. You work freely together to produce whatever we want to produce. Free travel, free education, goods and services. That is socialism, and it will not be won by reform campaigns, which are modifying isolated aspects of the present system. It can only be won by one concerted campaign, a broad front covering every one of these problems, because they're all interrelated. They're all caused by the same reason. So, in conclusion then, today there is a contradiction between great productive forces growing at an incredible pace and an outdated social hierarchy where the interests of a privileged elite are served at the expense of a majority. The threat of hunger and destruction is always there, whilst food is actually dumped and production is actually cut back, all for the sake of the same insane system of society which the majority still accept. So our message to you tonight is to resolve those contradictions by taking society into common democratic control, to put the destiny of humanity under the conscious control of humanity. And there are obviously still few revolutionary socialists, but this is the seed of the future, and the need is urgent. We have a world to save and a world to win.